Well, good morning. This is obviously a little bit unexpected, but I want to start off this morning by sharing with you a great piece of literature that I came in contact with this past year. Every year, for probably the last 3 or 4 years, I've started keeping track of all the books I read every year, and so I end up with this cool little list at the end of the year. You can look back and see what you read. But one of the great pieces of literature I read this past year, I want to share with you this morning. It's by a lady named Judith Viorst, and it's called Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. Starts off like this. I went to sleep with gum in my mouth, and now there's gum in my hair. And when I got out of bed this morning, I tripped on the skateboard, and by mistake, I dropped my sweater in the sink while the water was running. And I could tell it was going to be a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. At breakfast, Anthony found a Corvette Stingray car kit in his breakfast cereal box. And Nick found a junior undercover agent code ring in his breakfast cereal box. But in my breakfast cereal box, all there was breakfast cereal. I think I'll move to Australia. In the carpool, Mrs. Gibson let Becky have a seat by the window. Audrey and Elliot got seats by the window, too. I said I was being scrunched. I said I was being smushed. I said, if I don't get a seat by the window, I'm going to be carsick. No one even answered. I could tell it was going to be a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. However, Alexander's terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day doesn't compare too much to Pastor Steve's when he woke up this morning. He had a pain in his right lower back, and about 20 miles away on the other side of actually another town in Wheaton, I was waking up about the same time. I took a shower, got ready to go, walked downstairs, and found my housemate Ryan sleeping on the couch as I walked into the living room about to go out to church. And I was heading into the kitchen, and Ryan somehow woke up and said, "Hey, bro." And I said, "Hey." And he said, "You preaching at church this morning?" And I said, "No, I just get to show up this morning." So I walk in about 8:15 or so, and the moment I walk in, I know there's something wrong because everybody is kind of gathered around in the church office meeting area, and Pastor Steve is gathered around like this. And so everybody's kind of looking concerned, and at first, I thought Pastor Steve probably just walked in, you know, and slipped on the ice this morning and, you know, had hit his back and knocked something out of alignment. That was not the case. And so we started talking, and empathy is not one of my gifts. If you know me very well, you probably know this. I do great with ideas and like passion and discipline and all that. Empathy, if you need somebody to feel like you're feeling, don't come to me. I can try, but it will fail. I can tell you people to go too, but I'm not the one. But anyway, Pastor Steve's pain, though, became a little bit more personal to me when, as we were all standing around, he looks up and goes, "So can one of you guys preach this morning?" And for some reason, I found myself saying, "I can do that." John Wesley said to his preachers that you should be ready to preach, pray, or die at any given moment. And so praying is probably the easier of the three, but I figured preaching is probably better than the other. So anyway, so here we are, and as it turns out, I actually preached just about 2 weeks ago at my home church in Mississippi, and it's a message I've never done here, and the problem was, though, this morning, I didn't have that stuff with me. I mean, I basically knew what I said, but, you know, there's a good bit of distance from what's on the text of your Bible to what I'm actually going to say this morning. If you ever preach, you know this. So I called my good friend who lives in Wheaton, Stephen Lovett, PhD, and had him break into my house this morning and get my computer. So the message this morning is partially courtesy of Steve. He said, though, that he has broken and entered many times for the kingdom before, so don't worry, this isn't his first. So at any rate, here we are this morning, and I know, you know, we talked about Alexander at the beginning, we talked about Pastor Steve just a minute ago, and although you may have never had a kidney stone or had something quite that painful as what Pastor Steve was experiencing a few hours ago, you probably have had some of your own terrible, horrible, no good, very bad days. But sometimes those days turn into weeks, and sometimes those weeks turn into months and even terrible, horrible, no good, very bad years, and perhaps even for you, decades. And for many of us, the last year or so has perhaps been one of those years. Our country and our world has gone through a lot in the last year. Most particularly, we've been through a very divisive presidential election that has showed some of the deep divides between different people, even among various Christians in this country. And maybe even today, you're looking out across your Christian friends or even people in this congregation, you say, well, there are people that I've found out in the past year that I really disagree with at a very deep level about some things. And that's just thinking through the kind of big picture stuff. I mean, we've all lost this year. Some of us have lost relatives. Some of us have lost friends. Some of us have just had very difficult things happen, like losing jobs or important relationships. And so this morning, what I want to talk about is how to find hope. And I want to talk about one of the key ways that the Bible leads us to find hope, which is by looking to the past, looking, if you will, in the rearview mirror. And our text this morning is going to be from Psalm 77. This is a text that I've been thinking about a lot and God has really used in my life this past year. So if you want to grab your Bibles and turn to Psalm 77 in your pew Bible, I've got it written down somewhere. I had it written down. I think it's around 448, if I remember correctly. So if you can go ahead and turn there. Psalm 77, you'll notice in the little ascription at the beginning, is a psalm of Asaph. Now, Asaph was one of the chief musicians whom David appointed in the temple. You can read about him in 1 and 2 Chronicles. And 1 Chronicles tells us that Asaph was quite the virtuoso. It says that he could play, quote, loudly on harps and lyres and cymbals. That would be 1 Chronicles 15:16 for any of you electric guitar players and drum players who need to have a verse to quote whenever they ask you to turn down. Okay, so 1 Chronicles 15:16 played loudly on all those instruments. It also says that he was a hit songwriter who was ranked alongside David. You can read about that in 2 Chronicles 29:30. And actually, 12 of his psalms made it into the Psalter. Psalm 50 and then Psalms 73 through 83 are all Asaph psalms. And that's basically what we know about this guy. But as we begin Psalm 77, we find out that he is in a very difficult place. Whoever wrote this, whether it is Asaph or someone who's writing kind of in his line or ascribing it to him, he's in a very difficult place. So let's read this morning. I'm reading from the English Standard Version. Verse 1, I cry aloud to God, and he will hear me. In the day of my trouble, I seek the Lord. In the night, my hand is stretched out without wearying. My soul refuses to be comforted. When I remember God, I moan. When I meditate, my spirit faints. You hold my eyelids open. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. I consider the days of old, the years long ago. I said, let me remember my song in the night. Let me meditate in my heart. Then my spirit made a diligent search. Will the Lord spurn forever and never again be favorable? Has his steadfast love forever ceased? Are his promises at an end for all time? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his compassion? And then I said, I will appeal to this, to the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I will remember your wonders of old. I will ponder all your work and meditate on your mighty deeds. Your way, O God, is holy. What God is great like our God? You are the God who works wonders. You've made known your might among the peoples. You, with your arm, redeemed your people, the children of Jacob and Joseph. When the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. Indeed, the deep trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies gave forth thunder. Your arrows flashed on every side. The crash of your thunder was in the whirlwind. Your lightnings lighted up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was through the sea, your path through the great waters. Yet, your footprints were unseen. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. So the psalmist begins with his cry of anguish. God, where are you? Right? I cry aloud to God. It's incredible anguish and stress. He doesn't say why. We're not exactly sure what's going on, but he describes this intense pain that he is feeling. And the only thing that I can sum it up in my own experience that would be anything like what he seems to be describing here is last year when I got the flu. Now, last year, every year at Wheaton, they have flu shots that they offer. And as you walk through the student center, every year there will be some station offering to give you a flu shot. Well, I've never done it up until last year. And last year I said, you know, I really don't want to get the flu this year, so I think I'll give it a try this time around. So got my arm stuck. I was sore for a couple days, and I thought, okay, well, I'm probably good then. A couple months later, I wake up in the middle, early in the morning, and just have this incredible pain inside of me. And most of you know what this feels like, right? About 15 minutes later, you're sitting on the toilet. About 30 minutes later, you're probably sitting on the toilet and throwing up into a trash can at the same time. You can't go to sleep. Your eyes hurt. You try to sleep, but it doesn't work. You try to watch some Netflix. That doesn't work either. Everything just aches and hurts. It's just no good at all. Imagine that, except for imagine it actually being something that goes on for quite a while, right? And maybe it's even more emotional than that, some kind of real stress and anguish that is getting to you. This seems to be what the psalmist is feeling. And the crazy thing is that in verse 3 he says, when I remember God, right, the one who's supposed to help me, remember he's crying out to God to help him, but he says, when I remember God, I moan. Thinking about God does not help me. Thinking about God makes it worse. I wonder why. He says, when I meditate, presumably on God, my spirit faints. So when he thinks about God, the only person who can help him in this situation, it actually brings him more anguish than fixing the problem. So he's in quite a pickle. And I want you to notice, you might not have this if you're looking at the New Living Translation, which is what we have in the pew, but I want you to remember those two verbs, remember and meditate. In the Hebrew, those would be zakar. Can you say that with me? Zakar and Shiach. All right, let's say this together. Zakar and Shiach. Yeah, you got to get a little bit of that going. All right. Now, Zakar and Shiach, this isn't the last time we're going to see those, so I want you to remember those. But he goes on, and he just starts describing why he's feeling so bad in verse 4. He says, you hold my eyelids open, I'm so troubled that I cannot speak. And then he says, I consider the days of old. He's going to look back, the years long ago. And what it seems like he's doing here is the psalmist is looking back, and he's looking back to brighter days. We might say, in fact, I think this is what the New Living Translation says, the good old days. Or maybe you've heard the phrase, the glory days. He's thinking back to those times in his life, probably, when things were better for him. Or maybe even when things were better for the whole people of God. And when he thinks about how good things used to be, and contrasts that with what he's going through right now, it makes him moan. In fact, it even makes him question his relationship with God. It makes him question even who God is. And you know, I think we tend to do this too. We make the same move. Often we will look back to those glory days, whether it be glory days for each of us personally or glory days for a group we're part of, maybe it's even a church, and we look back and say, man, I just wish I could get back there. I wish I could get back to that, the way things used to be. Maybe it's, man, I remember when this church was in that other building and we had that really great community. I remember when we had Pastor so-and-so and they made us feel this way and, man, they were so awesome at this. And maybe they're just gone now and you just wish you could get back there. Or maybe you're thinking to yourself in terms of your career. Man, I remember I was really something 20 or 30 years ago, but I really feel like I've gotten off my mojo, and I want to figure out how to get back there. Or maybe there was a particular thing that was going on in your life, the way your family life was a couple decades ago, and you just wish you could get back. We tend to do this sort of move to think back to the glory days, and then use those glory days as a stick to beat ourselves over the head with about our present circumstances. Man, I just wish I could get back there. I wish it wasn't like it is now. So, he asks God some very difficult questions in the next few verses. Here's what I have. Will the Lord spurn forever and never again be favorable? Wow, that's a tough question to ask God. Has his steadfast love forever ceased? Is it okay to ask a question like that? How about this one? Are his promises at an end for all time? Wait a second, I thought Christians weren't supposed to have doubts. Has he in anger shut up his compassion? And I think I forgot one in there. Has his steadfast love forever ceased? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Five questions, five very difficult questions for God. I tell you, one thing that we learn here is that it is okay to confess your doubts to God and to ask him honest questions. I think a lot of the time we get this idea that we have to pray pretty prayers. Prayers that are theologically correct and prayers that sound like we have a smile on our face and prayers that just sound like the thing that we ought to say. Asaph didn't do that. David didn't do that. Jesus didn't do that all the time. My God, why have you forsaken me? Friends, it is okay to confess your doubts to God and to ask him your honest questions. And not only that, it's not only okay, there's also great power in doing so. Because when you ask God your honest questions about what is happening in your life and who he is in the midst of that, that lays it all out on the table so that he can deal with it. You see, our doubts and our fears, they love to hide in darkness. They love to hide in murky generalities, and we don't know exactly why we're feeling that way. We just have this feeling that something is bad. But when we lay it all out there in front of God and say, God, here are my grievances, here are my issues, here are my concerns, it actually puts it all out there so that he can point and he can deal with those things that we are having trouble with. So confessing your doubts is not only okay, it actually helps work toward the solution. It allows God to bring you to a different place. Sometimes the Lord helps you to realize, you know, that doubt is just silly. For instance, let's look at one of the questions. Has his steadfast love forever ceased? Let's just think about that one for a second. Has his steadfast love forever ceased? Is that even possible? Now, that's an honest question, and that's a good question to ask. But once you ask the question, you realize that it's a silly question. Has his steadfast love forever ceased? No, that's not possible. God is faithful. If his love is steadfast, it's not going to cease. But sometimes it also helps God asking this question allows God to help us work towards a solution. And that's what begins to happen in verse 10. Now, if you look down, if you're reading the Pew Bible, what you're going to have in front of you in verse 10 is this. And I said, this is my fate. The Most High has turned his hand against me. Verse 10 is incredibly difficult in the Hebrew. In fact, we're not exactly sure what it says. Isn't that amazing? With all the modern biblical scholarship, all those things we can do to try to get back, we are not exactly sure what Psalm 77:10 says. We got a couple good guesses, but the two guesses are pretty different. Here's what I have in the ESV. Then I said, I will appeal to this, to the years of the right hand of the Most High. And I actually think that's a little bit better. Let me read that one more time. Then I said, I will appeal to this, to the years of the right hand of the Most High. You see what he's done? He's laid all these questions out, and now he's decided how he is going to answer those questions. How do I answer that question about whether God is faithful? How do I answer that question about whether God will continue to be gracious? How do I answer that question that I have about God and his compassion? And what the psalmist says is, I'm going to answer that by looking back to the things God has done in the past. I'm going to look back to the past, God's faithfulness in the past, to find hope for the future. Now, I think this moment is pretty important because a lot of the time we don't actually get there. Some of us like to stay in this stage where we just live in the questions.
We throw our big questions out on the table. And we say, God, these are my grievances. These are the things I have problems with. And then we just live in that. We wallow in it. We just sit there for years and say, oh, I just feel terrible. I have these questions that I doubt God, and I don't want to move past it. But notice the psalmist doesn't stay in the questions. The questions are okay, but you can't live in the questions. You've got to move past those at some point and move towards some answers. And so what the psalmist has done with those questions, he's constructed this incredible mess, this knot. How do I untie this? They tell a story about King Alexander the Great when he was going through, and right before he was about to go conquer all of Asia, he went to this town called Gordium. And in Gordium, they had this knot that had been there for years, and it was called the Gordian Knot. And there was a prophecy about this knot that if anyone untied it, he would be the king of all Asia. And as you might imagine, Alexander was a little bit interested in this because he was interested in being the king of all Asia. So Alexander comes and he attempts to try to untie this knot, but he can't even find the ends of the rope. This is an incredibly intricate, complicated knot, and the ends, which is what you need to begin solving it, were actually hidden inside. So he gives it a couple tries, can't do it. So what does Alexander do in all of his brilliance? He whips out his sword and cuts it. Now, whether or not that was a legitimate way to win that particular prophecy, I'm not sure. And whether that story is true, I'm not sure. But what I think is interesting about that is that Alexander decided to solve the problem a different way than anybody before him had solved it. I had a roommate who had this happen to them one time. When I was in college, I had the same roommate for 4 years, Joel Archer. Joel was a missionary kid from Honduras. He was half Japanese, half American, Caucasian, I suppose I should say. And we met the year before. We came to Asbury University, and we decided to room together, so we roomed together all 4 years. But our freshman year, we had both gotten MacBooks. Back in the days when they had the nice little white ones, you know, and the black ones you get. So we both gotten like matching white and black MacBooks. It was really cute. And we had, in our dorm room, we also had gotten along with those some printers. And so they had this thing where you could get a free printer along with your MacBook. So we had our computers and our printers, and if you walked into our room, actually, that first semester, it was perfectly symmetrical. Like, you walk in, and if you were to walk in, you would see dressers, beds, desks, matching MacBooks except for different colors, and the same printer sitting on each desk. It was just incredibly embarrassing. So anyway, We had these printers, and I didn't have to actually do a lot of writing that semester, so I hadn't been using mine all that much, but Joel had this composition class where he was having to write a lot of papers. So about halfway through the semester, I walk into the room, and I see Joel taking apart his printer. And Joel is a very smart guy. In fact, I forgot to mention this. He's currently finishing up a PhD in philosophy at St. Louis University, and he wants to get another PhD in New Testament. After this one, two PhDs. The guy's insane. So he doesn't have the two PhDs yet, mind you. We'll see if he's actually able to make it all the way through. That's a lot of school. But anyway, so Joel's a very smart guy. He's taking apart his printer. I'm like, Joel, why are you taking apart your printer? He said, well, I ran out of black ink, right? He's been printing a lot, and I need to print out some notes, and I want to print them out in blue, because I have blue ink left over that I can use. So I'm trying to figure out how to take my printer apart and change the polarity so that when I tell it to print, it'll print in blue instead of black. Now, some of you with a little more common sense are probably thinking the same thing I was thinking, which is what I asked Joel. Joel, why don't you just highlight all the text on your computer and put it in blue and then print it, right? No, Joel wanted to try to do it by taking apart the printer. He hadn't even thought of that. The thought had not even crossed his mind. Now, the reason I had that thought was because probably like you, I am not smart enough. I know I'm not smart enough to figure out how to change the polarity on the printer. That thought would not even ever cross my mind, right? So I had to go with a different solution. Let's go ahead and make all the text blue in Microsoft Word and then punch print, right? That's my solution. But there are different ways of solving problems, right? And some ways work and some ways don't. One way to try to untie the Gordian knot is to try to actually untie it. Not going to work. Another way is to take your sword out and whack right through it. One way to try to get your printer to print in blue is to take the printer apart. Another way is to just make the text blue on your computer and push print. Some ways of solving problems work, some ways don't. What the psalmist here does is he goes to one of the key ways that Scripture tells us that we can find hope for the future. He decides to look back to the past. Now, I want you to notice something. In verse 6, those two verbs that I told you to think about, remember and meditate, pop up one more time. When he says, let me remember my song in the night, let me meditate in my heart. But then notice in verse 11, it comes up again. He says, I will remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I will remember your wonders of old. Now, remembering and meditating at the beginning of the psalm were two things. Those two actions were what were giving the psalmist so much anguish. He remembered God and he meditated, and that was what was dragging him even lower. Those same two actions in verse 11 are what begin bringing him toward a solution. He says, I will remember the deeds of the Lord. Yes, I will remember your wonders of old. He's going to look back to the past, and instead of God's faithfulness in the past being a stick that he can use to beat himself because the present isn't like that, he's going to look back to the past, and the past is going to become a resource where he can discover who God really is and find hope for the future. So, as you go down through the rest of the psalm, he begins talking about all the mighty things that God has done and all the great things who God is. So, in verse 13, your way, O God, is holy. What God is great like our God? You are the God who works wonders. You've made known your might among the peoples. You, with your arm, redeemed your people, the children of Jacob and Joseph. But then, in verses 16 through 20, he begins talking out about a very specific time where God did something for his people. Verse 16, it says, when the waters saw you, O God, when the waters saw you, they were afraid. So we got some waters, all right? I'm not sure what's going on quite yet. But then you get down to verse 19. He says, your way was through the sea, your path through the great waters. What is that talking about? Your way was through the sea. When did God go through the sea? The Red Sea, the Exodus, right? Remember, Israel, God's people, they were slaves in Egypt. And God says, I'm going to deliver my people and make them my people. So he sends his servant Moses to bring them out. There are all these plagues. And finally, the Pharaoh says, okay, we'll let them go. And he sends them away. But that's not the end of the story, right? They get to the edge of the Red Sea. They've got this massive body of water in front of them, and they can't get across it. And what do they see coming up behind them? They see Pharaoh and his army. They've got nowhere to go. They're caught between a rock and a hard place. And what does God do? God says, Moses, stretch out your hand. Stretch out your arm. And God parts the waters before them. He makes a highway for them to go across. They go to the other side. And this is where Israel becomes Israel. If that story doesn't happen, there is no Israel. There is no Psalm 77. There is no Jesus. This is the great thing that God does for his people. So he looks back and says, if God can do that, if God can make a way through the Red Sea, if he can part the waters, what can't he do for me? If God can do that for those people then, what couldn't he do for me right now? In the midst of my anguish, in the midst of my pain. Another thing that's interesting about this is that the thing that he looks back to, that thing, that memory, is not just something about himself alone. Asaph doesn't just say, what is that thing that God did for just me, right? Maybe it was, well, I had a really bad grade and, you know, my teacher in psalm writing school gave me a second try on it or something, right? He doesn't say that. He looks back at something really big that God did for God's people as a whole, not just for something that God did for him. He's looking bigger than just the individual. And he looks back and says, wow, like if God could do that, what can't he do now? I don't know what that thing is for you. You know, when we think about corporately, what is that thing for you that you would say, man, if God did that, and I know he did, what couldn't he do for me now? Maybe for you individually, it has something to do with how God maybe brought you together with your spouse, or maybe how he healed you from a disease, maybe a particular point of clarity where you just knew in your life that God was speaking to you and leading you in a certain way. And maybe you don't feel that clear clarity right now, but you know that God works like that. I don't know what that is for you. For me, a couple of those moments in my life were in the summer of 2010 when I went to India. When I left for India, I was not planning. I didn't want to preach. I wasn't really interested in pastoring. I wasn't interested in doing what I'm doing right this very moment. When I went to India, I think I've told this story before, I was going to teach Greek and Hebrew at a Bible college. And when I got there, they didn't know what I couldn't do. So they asked me to do everything. So they said, we got 75 to 80 students we want you to teach Greek and Hebrew to. That was sort of expected, but I was expecting like 10 to 15 students, not 75 to 80 students. They said things like, oh, would you like to come speak at our prayer meeting on Saturday? Would you be willing to speak in chapel? You know, we're going out to a village, like a rural Indian village this weekend. We need an evangelist. Would you be willing to be our village evangelist? Who do they think I am? Like Billy Graham or something? They didn't know that I wasn't Billy Graham. So they asked me to do everything. And through that experience, the Lord began to help me realize how he was calling me. I started to think thoughts like, you know, this preaching thing isn't so bad. I could probably do it if I knew what I was talking about. Or, you know, I kind of like teaching. I never realized that before. And through that experience, God began to call me toward what I'm doing now. Preaching here, being in school at Wheaton, all these things that I'm doing now. And your story doesn't need to be exactly like that. But you do have a story, and you need to know your story. Because it's hard to remember what God has done for you if you've never even thought about what God has done for you. So look back. Look back to those moments where you know that God has been faithful, where you know that his hand was leading you. And then tell yourself, self, right? Self, wake up, look at what God has done for you, and find hope for the future. If that's what God can do then, what couldn't he do now? But it needs to be bigger than that too. It doesn't need to just be about you or just about me. We need to look back and see the big stuff that God has done. Things like God sent Jesus, his son, to die on a cross for us so that people like me and almost everybody else in this room who are not ethnic Jews can come to God apart from the law, apart from having to obey the Torah. No, we get to come based on faith in Jesus Christ, right? And not only that, God sent his Spirit. God poured out his Spirit upon his church so that we could be his witnesses in this world. And so you don't have to live in bondage to your sin. You can live a life of freedom because of the Spirit working in and through you. Each of us can. God has done some big stuff for us. And when we look back to those things that we know God has done, that's where we can find confidence for the future. So here's how I would put what I think is the big point of this psalm. This phrase: God's faithfulness in the past gives hope for the future. God's faithfulness in the past gives hope for the future. Your past does not need to be a stick that you use to beat your present over the head with. Your past is the place where you find out who God really is and learn what he can do for you in the future. So there are two questions I want to pose to you this morning. One is one that I want us to think about right this moment. Another one is one I want you to carry with you maybe for later in the week. The one for later in the week is this. What is one way, just one, that you know God has been faithful in the past? What is that thing, that anchor that you want to look back to? Maybe it's something in Scripture. Maybe it's something that God has done for his people as a whole. Maybe it's a promise that you find there. Maybe it's something that God has done for you particularly. But where is that anchor where you say, when I'm questioning everything else in my life, I still know that this is true? What is that for you? Take that one with you. The one that I want to think about this morning. We ended up at the Red Sea, right? So here's my question. What is that Red Sea challenge that you want God's help with this week? Or maybe it's this month, or maybe it's this year. What is that challenge that's ahead of you, and you just see it, and it looks like a barrier that you cannot get across? And you say, I know God is calling me through that, and I know he's going to give me help, but this is what I want prayer for. Darren, would you go ahead and come and sing? We're going to close with a song, but I want this to be a time of response. So you can stay where you are and lift that request up to God, or we would also want to invite you to come forward. And I want to ask the pastoral team if they would come up and just be present here for those who need prayer. But I want you to bring that thing and lay it before God. What is that Red Sea challenge that you have out ahead of you? What is that thing that you know that I need God's help? This isn't something I can just power through on my own. I can't get across this Red Sea on my own. I must have God's faithfulness. I must have God's help to make it through. You might want to lay that before the Lord at this altar. You might want to lay that before the Lord from where you are in your seat. But let's bring these things before God and ask for his help and ask that he would give us hope for the future in these very real and difficult situations that we find ourselves in this very morning. So as we pray and as we sing, you come. Be sensitive to anyone who needs to get out of the pew. If you're sitting down, just be aware of that. But you come now as we pray and offer these things up to the Lord.